Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m, and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and you're listening to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. From maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest this week is guide dog owner Paul Fuller, who recently joined Scope as their Executive Director of Partnerships. After a long career as a graphic designer, working for the BBC and Sky. Hello, Paul, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Well, thank you, Toby. It's a pleasure to be here. A tough ask, not purely to choose songs that penetrate my soul, but perhaps even harder, 7 songs that have marked milestones of my life.
It's always a tricky question, that one, when I ask people, you know, was it an easy task selecting your tracks? And from your answer just now, it sounds like it probably was quite a tricky task.
Oh, it was impossible. Can't believe you gave me that task. But hopefully, when I listen back, I'll be pleased with my choices.
Well, the first track that you have chosen, Paul, is one from your parents' record collection. It's Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach with Walk On By, and one which I think you have on permanent loan. Can you sort of tell me what age you were when you first heard this track, and where were you?
Well, I was born 5th of June 1964 to Don and Barbara Fuller, brought up in Kent, with a few foreign adventures to Africa, thanks to my dad's job. It was a sort of happy childhood, no particular desire to learn from teachers, I must confess, but a love of books, swimming, and a natural desire and ability to draw and paint. And rummaging around in my parents', what would you describe it as, wooden box that hid their record player, there was a sort of a collection of show tunes, Oklahoma and West Side Story, Val Dunican, it was another one that struck out, but the one that touched my soul, the one that I wished to, as you describe, permanently borrow from my parents when I left home, was Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach with Walk On By.
And I think we've all dived into our parents' record collection, and maybe their tastes have probably influenced our early music tastes too, don't you think?
I think that is true. However, my parents had a love of going to the theatre to sort of see Cats, Les Miserables, what others do I remember from the trips, Phantom of the Opera. They were all family outings which were highly enjoyable. I wouldn't say, with the exception of Les Miserables, which I continue to listen to occasionally, but their sort of love of show tunes is something that I enjoyed in my youth, but not necessarily something that I've continued to listen to.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by, walk on by, make believe that you don't see the tears, just let me.
So Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach there with Walk On By, and a record that I think you have on permanent loan, Paul. For your next track, Paul, we move to school days for you. Where did you go to school, and what was school life like for you, and were your eyes sort of okay at that time?
Yeah, good questions. So, as I said, Kent was where my education was, so I moved from Homewood House, which I think I mentioned to you, I had an ability to draw and paint, so I got an art scholarship to Cranbrook, and I think it would be fair to say that during this childhood, I was very unaware of the fact that I might have sight challenges difficulties in adult life. I do remember a Cub Scout jamboree where we were all camping, and I remember after the sort of sing-along around the campfire, we were told that we could go off into the woods and play, and I remember with amazement watching those around me rushing into the forest and thinking, how are you doing that? How can you be so certain you're not going to run into a tree? So perhaps there was some slight inkling of sight challenges, but nothing that I really knew of. So yes, this was schooling. I was at boarding school at Cranbrook. Very happy time there. And then from Cranbrook, I moved on to Art College, Ravensbourne, and then on to Middlesex.
And school life back in the 70s and 80s, because that's the time when I went through school as well, it's very different to school life today. Do you think your time at school was maybe either harder or easier than kids today? And, you know, putting COVID aside for one moment, but do you think school life was easier or harder for you back then?
I think it's you kind of grow up and accept. So it did not strike me as peculiar that I slept in a bedroom with 12 other school attendees, my friends at Cranbrook in my boarding house. That was all good. I don't believe it was harder. You just accepted that sometimes the water was cold when you wanted a shower, and that it really was possible to have six meals in a row that all involved sausages. So I don't believe that children today would have accepted it without speaking out perhaps a bit more. But it was a good time. You know, there was lots of listening to and discussing albums. You know, when I touched on with you earlier about sort of the difficulties of choosing the right songs, I kind of feel that I should apologise to The Jam, Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, Adam and the Ants, Kate Bush, John Lennon. All were sort of fantastic memories from my childhood, and obviously at that time as well, with a love of art, it was a happy discussion of album covers as well as listening to the songs.
Yeah, I do remember the album covers back then, and the fantastic thing was, you know, all the artwork that was on the album cover and the sleeves, and, you know, when 12 inches came in and you went to a record store and there was lines and lines of fantastic imagery. And I think it was a good time for design and graphics back then.
I think you're absolutely right. I am certain that that is what drove me in the direction of my career. I think as a 17, 18 year old, I would have said to you that I aspired to design album covers when I was older. That would have definitely been the aspiration. But as I moved into art college and appreciated commercials on television, I started to imagine myself becoming potentially a famous movie director at some point in my life.
And Paul, what is the track that takes you back to those school days, and why have you chosen it?
Yeah, so this was obviously a tough one, having given you a bit of a list of songs. But David Bowie has been with me throughout my life, so it felt very appropriate to choose one of his songs, of which there are so many. But I've chosen Changes by David Bowie.
David Bowie and Changes there. Your next track, Paul, takes you to leaving art college, starting work at the BBC, and also finding out that you had an eye condition that would lend to blindness. There must have been quite a lot going on at that time. And for you, as somebody who's taken, you know, a path in the arts, doing an art degree and starting a job as a graphic designer, knowing now, do you think that you would have preferred for your parents to have told you earlier about your eye condition?
So the 80s, you know, as you so rightly said, I left Middlesex Art College, joined the BBC. I think I would have been about 21, 22. I think I'd been at the BBC approximately a week when my parents phoned and said, you know, would you like to come for supper? I knew it wasn't going to be an ordinary supper when, again, this is from my own memory. I'm not sure it's the same memory that my parents might share, but I remember my mother was crying. I remember that they were trying to tell me that I was going blind, which struck me as very peculiar. I didn't feel at the time that there were any particular eyesight challenges. I think now on reflection, it must have been extraordinarily hard for them. So they had known since childhood that I had this rare hereditary eye disorder called choroideremia, and that as I later learnt from Moorfields, its potential for taking my eyesight was quite broad. I think that even Moorfields at the time was saying that I needed to prepare to lose my eyesight between the ages of 30 and 70, which was quite a sort of a wide parameter. I do remember sort of saying to my mum, why didn't you tell me earlier? And she answered, well, growing up is hard enough, which actually I think that's a good enough answer. You know, I think can't imagine the challenges for them to be told that potentially my career might be shorter than I would wish. That was quite challenging. But the time that they chose to tell me, that kind of transition through from having studied in the arts to finding myself at the BBC in a job that I absolutely adored, I think all of that helped to make that transition easier. So never would I want to be in their position, and I can't imagine how challenging it must be for so many parents who know that their children have hereditary disorders, and how and when they choose to tell their children must be enormously challenging.
And did you think at that time that your career was at an end, or did you think, okay, well, my career is going to probably continue for a few years and at some point I'm going to have to think of other things?
I felt that my career would be shorter than I wanted, but I then decided that I would embrace the disappointment, and I believe it created within me the desire to work longer and harder, because I thought, I'm not going to have the same length of career as those around me.
And did you tell your work colleagues at the time at all about your eye condition, or was it something that you sort of kept to yourself and to your family?
I think whether through conscious or unconscious bias, I just felt it was too much to tell the BBC. And then when I moved jobs to Sky, I, in fact, for the whole of my career, never spoke about it with my employers. To jump ahead, in fact, to at the point when I stopped working with Sky, my boss at the time reached out and said, you know, is there something that you would like to talk about, Paul? We're worried about you. And I remember looking at him and sort of saying, you know, I'm sorry, Barney, I'm not prepared to talk about it. So yes, Toby, throughout my whole career in broadcast, I never referred to the fact that I was losing my sight.
And what is the track that takes you back to those times? Because I think it's got quite a nice statement to it as well.
Again, each track that I announce comes with an apology. This one to sort of Marvin Gaye and to Stevie Wonder, it's not you. I chose Life's What You Make It by the extraordinary band Talk Talk. And I don't even think that I truly appreciated at the time of this being constantly on my record player that perhaps it was what I aspired for life to be.
So Talk Talk there, and Life's What You Make It, and a statement for everyone, and maybe something that we should all live our lives by as well. We are now moving into the 90s, Paul, and a move, as you say, from the BBC to Sky, meeting your wife and starting a family as well. How did you and your wife first meet?
So, yes, I left the BBC and joined Sky, I think around 1989, right at the start. And first of all, I moved on to Sky News, where I was working on a programme called the International Business Report, where they had a young reporter who I really rather liked called Jacqueline. I took her out a couple of times, and allegedly, on our first date, I don't believe this, by the way, I told her that we couldn't get married because I was going to go blind and that I couldn't have children because I didn't think that that was appropriate. To make you all smile, hopefully, within 4, maybe 5 months of making that statement, Jacqueline told me the rather extraordinary news that I was about to become a father, and hastily were married. In fact, I believe that my wife once pointed out to me that I'd known her longer pregnant than not pregnant before Zach came into the world. This, of course, has a very positive and happy continuation. Jacqueline is still one of the most exceptional people in my life, very blessed. And as you so rightly said, Toby, perhaps I compressed a lot into a couple of years in that having arrived at Sky, I found that I had a wife and son all in very quick succession. Zachary is now about to be 30, and again, sort of a rather wonderful addition to my life. So I'm incredibly grateful for perhaps I wouldn't have been smart enough to make such quick life choices. So rather blessed that perhaps the world accelerated in a way that I wasn't able to control, but I am the beneficiary of it.
And what is the track that you have chosen that marks meeting your wife, getting married and starting a family then?
Well, I'd had to have a George Michael track in amongst my selection. I still listen and miss George. And so this is from Wham, and the track is Everything She Wants.
Somebody told me, or everything she wants is everything she sees. I guess I must have loved you.
Everything She Wants There by George Michael, and one for your wife and family too, Paul. The next track, Paul, we move to maybe 2012, which for some people probably was quite a good time because it was the London 2012 Olympics and Paralympics, but a bit of a worrying time for you and your family as well, as you were diagnosed with cancer and spent some time in hospital. It must have been a very anxious time for you, your wife, and your families too.
Yeah, it must have been. One should never overlook the challenges that one brings to one's family. I'd, through the Olympics, noted that I'd had really significant earache, and I'd been to the GP a couple of times and to an ENT specialist as well. And then during an endoscopy, the ENT specialist sort of put his hand on my shoulder and said, there's a lump, but don't worry, a light spot of chemo should fix it. And I went back to my wife and said, I think I've been told I have cancer, but I wasn't brave enough to ask. So it was a tough time. It was a very unexpected diagnosis. I'm so grateful to the Royal Marsden because obviously I'm here now. And during that treatment, which was a combination of radio and chemo, where the cancer sat underneath my tongue, they couldn't actually operate on it. So a couple of long stays in the Royal Marsden, whilst actually watching Channel 4's extraordinary Paralympics coverage. But I would start each morning with Bob Marley and Don't Worry About a Thing, or Everything Is Going to Be All Right, which I really hoped it was. So yes, thank you to all those that got me through that, to my family, and obviously thanks to Bob Marley as well.
Bob Marley there, and Don't Worry About a Thing, and a really positive theme in that track there. Paul, we are now coming to a more recent time for you, and a few things happening all at the same time in your life. You went blind, you left Sky, started on a wonderful trip on travelling around the world, or you got a guide dog, and you started an interest in the third sector and eventually joined Scope. So a lot happening at the same time? Well, I hope not all at the same time.
It certainly felt like it. So having thankfully got past the cancer, returned to Sky, but my love of the role had diminished. You know, Sky had provided so much. I'd been to Augusta, I'd been to Barbados for the Cricket World Cup, I'd even been to sort of Flushing Meadow for the tennis, so really extraordinary opportunities. And then when I returned, somehow the magic wasn't there. I'm still to this day uncertain, but really after the treatment that saved my life, my eyesight just seemed to sort of disappear. And as you so rightly touched upon, I left Sky, and I'm just trying to think about what next. And for that first couple of years, what next involved travelling. My wife and I went to India on a train, which was brilliant. We went to Vietnam, Cambodia. The reason we went to Vietnam, my beloved daughter, Natasha, was on her gap year. She'd made the fatal error of phoning home from Laos and saying, "Oh, I'm going to Vietnam next." And I remember, as all shamefaced fathers might, sort of blurting out, would it be all right if your mother and I came to visit you in Vietnam?" Thankfully, not only is she a wonderful daughter, but she's very kind as well, and said, "Yes, that would be lovely." I'm not sure she meant it. We had a fantastic time with her in Vietnam. Prior to going travelling, I had had guide dogs come to my house to ascertain whether I would be a appropriate owner of a guide dog. I had an extraordinary piece of luck there, which I didn't appreciate at the time. One of the young GDIs had wanted to come out and see the process. His name was Sam, and whilst we were away travelling, Sam had a return of a guide dog, a large guide dog, and the best thing there is that, thankfully, as a man of 6'2", when a large guide dog is returned to guide dogs and they think to rehome him, they need to think of larger people. And Sam said, "Do you know what? I think I have met the right person for Bolt." It's a gentleman called Paul Fuller. And because of the sort of the compression of time, Bolt and I met at King's Cross. And it was ascertained that he and I would make a good partnership. And I had all the training at King's Cross with Sam. And Bolt came back with me and has been truly life-changing. You know, I'm so lucky to have him. I can't quite emphasize how life-changing a guide dog is. I don't believe it's for everyone. I kind of think that one has to be a dog lover. I don't know if you agree, Toby, but I
think you're definitely right there. I mean, I grew up with dogs. My parents always had dogs. And then when I applied for my first guide dog, which was quite an interesting experience for many reasons, and making that decision of actually applying, you know, once you start being guided by your first dog, it is just such a moving experience. And as you say, it's not for everybody, but for those people, it can, as you say, change your life in so many ways.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? You know, I now work in the third sector, which I know we'll talk about, but the charity that I work with, Scope, one of their five goals is independence. I can't adequately describe the independence that Bolt provides, and the joy, the emotional support as well.
You mentioned the third sector there. Where did that sort of come from? Because obviously you're working in a creative industries and then moving to the third sector. Where sort of come out of the blue a bit, perhaps?
Absolutely. So I was very lucky that Sky had been very generous when I left them, and I had felt that I would be retiring. You know, again, I'd sort of mentioned to you earlier, Toby, the sort of the positive view I had of retirement through my father. And so I've found myself thinking that I might like to sort of perhaps be a trustee. I looked at the possibilities with the RNIB and also with guide dogs. And I just didn't feel quite right. But it didn't, you know, there was something there that I knew that perhaps the third sector held opportunities, but those weren't the ones for me. And then a recruitment company that had aligned me to the trustee role with Guide Dogs contacted me and said, "Have you really retired?" And I kind of went, "Well, yes, I believe I have." And they went, "Because there's a opportunity for director of partnerships at the charity Scope, and we've looked at your CV and we think you'd actually make a really good possibility for this role." So as I said to you, Toby, I'd kind of thought that I'd retired, but I've cheekily perhaps said, "Well, let me have a conversation with the CEO, and if I think it's a good fit, I will apply." Well, imagine this is a quick shout out to Mark Hodgkinson, who I met on Zoom, thanks to the strange world we all now live in, and chatted with him and felt that actually, you know, the third sector, the 14 million disabled people of which you and I are both members, was something that I was very interested in and would like to work within. So I applied for the role.
And Paul, what is the track that marks all these sort of changes in your life at that time?
As we moved sort of swiftly onto the travelling and the moving into the third sector, I'd been very prepared for an emotional crash. I kind of thought that having spent the first 40, 45, 50 years of my life with the ability to see being paramount to my career, that when that was taken from me, I felt that I would go into a very dark place. I prepared for that through sort of the RNIB provides counselling. I met an amazing man, I'll give him a shout out, called Malachi, who really talked to me about what I should be prepared for, and anger and disappointment. But ultimately, it never came, much to my surprise. And for a while, I actually believed that I might be deceiving myself. So that's why I chose the track by Duran Duran, another band who've been with me throughout my life. And the track that I've chosen is Come Undone. And there's a very beautiful line in that, which is to do with who do you know, who do you trust when you come undone? And I felt that was very poignant, because I really did have to sort of turn in on the sort of emotional support of my rather extraordinary family, who've all been incredibly supportive on this journey.
Duran Duran there, and Come Undone, and a poignant track for you, Paul. From chatting with you, Paul, today, I think you might be a sort of positive kind of person, always thinking there's a way through life, and maybe thinking that, you know, you can get through life and things happen for a reason, and, you know, just get on in it with it, and life's what you make it. Am I right in thinking you are quite a positive kind of person?
I'm definitely a glass is half full. And I'm certain that that is one's nature, not nurture. I always seem to have had that ability to think, yeah, this has happened, but look how this might lead to other possibilities. And I think that that has obviously protected me very well through the sort of the ups and downs of life. I kind of think that it's a beautiful lead into my track 7, my final uplifting track, which could have been any of so many fantastic and amazing Nile Rodgers songs. But as I touched on with you, since taking that break, that traveling break, my wife and I have been to many concerts. We were at a Nile Rodgers and Chic concert, and Nile Rodgers gave what I believe is a rather sort of amusing anecdote, where he said after he'd been diagnosed with cancer and told that he should put his affairs in order because he had sort of potentially only weeks to live, he said, two French dudes called me up and they wondered if I would create a song with them. Well, the song that they all wrote together was Daft Punk and Nile Rodgers' Get Lucky. And why it really resonated with me is it has a beautiful lyric. Our ends were beginnings. I love that.
Well, on that note, Paul Fuller, thank you very much indeed for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Toby, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.